Good morning. I call to order this remote meeting of the House Commerce Committee and ask Mr. Brown to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Cotizza-Watoon.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Present.
Representative Barr.
Present.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson present.
Representative Daphne.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Haley.
Present.
Representative Cagle. Representative
present.
Lee. Thank you.
Cagle present.
Thanks. Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lilly. Representative Liz Lagarde.
Liz Lagarde present.
Representative Lucero.
Two cups of coffee for two concurrent 10:30 committees.
Representative Olson. Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Richardson. Excused. Representative Tice. Again, I will call Representative Lilly. Representative Olson, it looks like she's just joining us now. And then Representative Tice. And Representative Tice is just joining us now as well.
A quorum is present. Our first item of business is approval of our minutes from our last meeting. Representative Cotizza-Watoon, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move the minutes.
All right. Any discussion to the Cotizza-Watoon motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails in the minutes for February 24th, 2021 are approved. This is, of course, a special meeting of the House Commerce Committee, and we do have a packed agenda. Because I'm asking the committee to meet on a Friday morning, I wanted to make sure to make we make good use of the time, so I did schedule a number of bills. I do want the committee to know that it's entirely possible we won't get through all the bills on the agenda today. I just didn't want to have a day where we ask you to be here on a Friday morning and then didn't make very good use of the time. So we'll move as expeditiously as we can through it. The first bill on the agenda is mine, so I will hand the virtual gavel over to Representative Cotizza-Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 844 be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
Okay. Chair Stevenson moves that House File 844 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. We also do have an author's amendment labeled A4. Would you like to go ahead and move that amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like the committee to consider today?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move the A4, which is an author's amendment. It represents a culmination of a lot of discussions with a lot of people in our business community, and most notably the Retailers Association, who just I can't say enough about how constructive and positive they have been to work with. So I'd ask the committee to adopt the A4.
Members, any discussion on the A4 amendment? Seeing no hands, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the A4 amendment is adopted. Chair Stevenson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, earlier this month, we had an extreme weather event that covered most of the middle of the country. Record cold, ice, snow hit Texas, Oklahoma, and other states. Due to deregulation, incompetent grid management, and impossibly poor planning by both public and private sector officials in Texas, hundreds of thousands of Americans went without power for days. And in fact, I heard on the radio as I was coming in to the state office building this morning that there are still thousands of people in Texas without access to clean water. Across Texas, there were reports of huge spikes in the prices of essential goods and services. Food, bottled water, and hotel rooms surged in price, making a terrible situation even worse. Some hotels that still had power increased their prices over $1,000 a night. The price of natural gas also spiked to unconscionable levels. Gas that normally sold for $2 a decatherm sold for over $1,000 a decatherm on the Oklahoma market. Texans are now facing energy bills in the thousands upon thousands of dollars. The fact that people profited to an absurd extent that they took advantage of the pain and misery of others in a moment of desperation is just morally bankrupt. Fortunately for Texans, their state has a law against price gouging in an emergency, and it's a tough one. Violators can face fines of up to $250,000. Investigations are ongoing, and law enforcement officials in the state are promising action. 35 other states have laws against price gouging during a disaster. Minnesota, by contrast, has no such law, and our citizens would be without recourse if something like what happened in Texas were to happen here. This bill would change that. It would make it illegal to price gouge during a disaster declared by the governor. It would fine people who do price gouge and allow for restitution for victims. It also establishes clear expectations for what is permissible and impermissible pricing behavior during an emergency. Businesses won't be left wondering what they can and can't do. You know, one thing I love about living in Minnesota is that when a disaster strikes, we really do take care of each other, and it never really fails. Whether it's as simple as helping a stranger out of the ditch after a bad snowstorm, or the people in my district who hand-sewed masks for healthcare workers when we had the PPE shortages last spring, Minnesota is full of good people with big hearts, and that extends to our business community. I really believe that the vast majority of businesses in Minnesota would never engage in this kind of behavior. They want to be, and in fact are, good members of our community. But the fact that a few people in Minnesota would price gouge doesn't mean that there shouldn't be accountability for those that do. This bill is about ensuring that accountability. It's about protecting Minnesotans when they're most vulnerable. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer questions, but first I think we have some testifiers, including the Attorney General.
Certainly. Thank you, Chair Stevenson, for introducing your bill. First on the list, I do have Attorney General Keith Ellison. Mr. Attorney General, would you like to introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony?
Yes, Madam Chair, and Ranking Member and all members, thank you all for allowing us to be a part of this vital conversation. Representative Stevenson, my thanks to you for bringing forward this much-needed bill to combat price gouging in Minnesota in times of emergency. You know, the fact is that during the COVID pandemic, we did see price gouging. We had to pass an executive order to prevent it. I'm glad that my colleague in Texas, Mr. Ken Paxton, has the tools he needs to try to protect Texans. We need similar tools here, and I think that this is a very thoughtful compromise, and I hope that the committee looks favorably. You know, protecting Minnesota consumers from being taken advantage of by predatory pricing practices in the middle of a public health crisis, weather disasters, and other emergencies is fundamental to helping all Minnesotans afford their lives and live with dignity and respect. As amended, House File 844 would prohibit price gouging of essential goods and services during and after for 30 days a public emergency is declared by the governor. The bill focuses on core essential goods and services necessary for public health and welfare, and a non-exhaustive list that includes food, fuel, lodging, and medical goods and services. Just so folks know, we're not talking about pricey goods here. We're talking about things that people need to survive. The bill also prevents sellers from charging prices that are in gross disparity with pre-emergency prices. Importantly, this bill balances the needs of retail sellers by allowing sellers to increase prices if their wholesale costs go up, which is perfectly understandable, and by prohibiting price increases at earlier points in the chain of distribution that harm retail sellers and end up hitting consumers. You know, the COVID-19 pandemic has shown us the importance of putting price ceilings on in place during emergencies. Not all the time, just during emergencies. In the early days of COVID-19, Governor Walz put in place a price gouging prohibition that I've already mentioned that prevents sellers from charging more than 20% over the product's pre-pandemic price. There was a defense that if the wholesale prices for the retailer went up exorbitantly, the retailers had a defense, which we thought was appropriate. But that executive order helped us, and we used it quite a lot. The Attorney General's office has taken significant actions under the executive order. That's Executive Order 2010, including more than 2,400 complaints received and investigated. We've responded to them all. More than 100 informal resolutions after the contact. That means our people call them up, they tell them what the executive order says, and they say, you can't do that. And the retailers say, I get it, okay. 6 court file settlements stopping gouging behavior and recovering restitution for Minnesotans. And these are representative of the items that we've received many of the complaints about in the early days of COVID. And as you all recall, when the quarantine went into place and the pandemic started, it really did evolve. In the beginning, we were having to enforce on certain items. That changed as supply increased. And I think everybody on this call probably remembers those empty shelves of toilet paper. That's quite a visual for you. Anyway, N95 and KN95 masks for as much as $13 a mask. Bottom line is that, I can identify the people we had to sue. I don't see a need to put their name back out there again. They're in compliance now. Toilet paper for $3 a roll. Again, we had to take enforcement action to stop that kind of conduct. Eggs at 3 times the pre-emergency price. We've had to take action on that. And rice and a few other non-perishable food products at double and triple pre-emergency prices. So those are some things that we have to step up and take some action on. Now, let me wrap up, Madam Chair, by just pointing out, that the order is limited to COVID-related price gouging and will end when the governor's emergency declaration is terminated. But there's other emergencies that happen. Sadly, they do happen with frequency, extreme weather events, other things like that. And we need a permanent piece of legislation enacted not by the governor during an emergency, but by the legislature, the people's house, so that all of us can say, hey, this is what we've decided as a state. We need a law that will protect Minnesotans during these future emergencies, as Minnesota lacks the tools to combat price gouging that are common throughout the rest of the country. As the chair pointed out, 35 states, plus the District of Columbia, have state price gouging laws in place, including Texas. And so this does span the political spectrum. Just as I wrap up, 2 quick examples of recent price gouging in Minnesota that illustrate the problem. Shortly after 9/11, gas prices skyrocketed in Minnesota in September 2001. And the Attorney General investigated but lacked the ability to take action against those price gougers. In the winter of 2013 and 14, historically cold weather caused propane prices to spike to more than 3 times the usual prices in Minnesota, leading to a peacetime emergency declaration by the governor. And we should be proactive. We should ensure that the protections are placed for Minnesotans before the next natural disaster or public health emergency strikes, and make sure that consumers are not left at the mercy of price gougers. So, Madam Chair and members, I thank you for allowing the Attorney General's office to be involved in this conversation. If you have any questions, I have 2 staff who are ready to help answer questions. They're Jason Plagenkuhl, who's head of our consumer division, very able lawyer, and Eric Maloney, another really awesome lawyer who I hope the people of the state of Minnesota are proud of, because I'm proud of them both. They are in the trenches, protecting Minnesotans every day. So I'll just wrap up right there, and they will be available to answer questions. So thank you very much, and I yield back.
Thank you for your testimony, Attorney General Ellison. Mr. Chair, would you like to introduce your next testifier?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to introduce Bruce Neustadt of the Minnesota Retailers Association. And before I hand it over to him, I just want to thank him and his association for their very constructive approach to this bill. We've had a lot of conversations in the last few days, in a week or so. They were difficult at times, and they pushed really hard, but in a very fair and constructive way. And I think the bill is substantially better for those conversations. And I really appreciate that kind of constructive approach. So Bruce Newstead.
Mr. Newstead, please introduce yourself, state your name for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Katisa Watoon and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Newstead. I'm the staff president of the Minnesota Retailers Association. We're a trade association of about 1,200 storefronts across Minnesota. About a third of those are small businesses, usually one or two store operations. About a third are mid-sized businesses, and about a third are kind of some of the national brands that you'd recognize. Just want to take a brief moment this morning to speak in support of House File 844 as amended. We've greatly appreciated the opportunity to work with Chair Stevenson on the amendment that we think provides a better approach to addressing bad actors during an emergency. As amended, we think the bill goes a long way toward providing clarity for consumers, retailers, and regulators. As you heard, an important part of that clarity relates to when this price gouging statute would kick in. And as I heard, but I think want to be clear about, it really does require a governor's declaration of an emergency and an invoking of this statute with some specific geography. In addition, we really appreciate that the bill defines, while it defines what price gouging is, equally as important, it provides some clarity as to what price gouging is not. And I just want to thank the chair and others, the attorney general, for recognizing the vast majority of Minnesota businesses do things right and won't get caught up in this. And I just want to say on a final note, because the statute does require a declaration, such as the one we're under right now, under the pandemic, we sincerely hope this statute is really rarely used. So thank you, Chair Stevenson. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for allowing me to testify. And we appreciate this thoughtful dialogue on this bill. We know these conversations are difficult. And as the chair pointed out, once you sort of end up outside of your comfort zone all the way around. But we pledge to continue to work with the chair, legislators, and other stakeholders as this bill progresses. So happy to stick around for any questions, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Newstead. My internet had a bit of a delay there. Sorry if I'm on a delay. Next on my list, I have Jamie Fool with the Minnesota Grocers Association. Please excuse mispronunciation of your name. Please introduce yourself and state your name for the record.
Madam Chairs, members of the committee, Jamie Pool. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak this morning. Again, I'm Jamie Pool, president of the Minnesota Grocers Association. And I'm here just to talk about House File 844 and the realities that our industry experienced during the COVID-19 crisis. I want to thank Chair Stevenson. He certainly has been open in discussion with us and for bringing this conversation forward. It's an incredibly important conversation, but I do think it needs to be well-rounded. And I just want to share again what we experienced. As you all well are aware, Minnesota has a very unique culture in that we do have hundreds of hometown grocers and convenience stores, many of whom are independent, multi-generational, and locally owned. They create jobs, support local charities, and provide a safe, responsible shopping experience. The MGA is their state trade association. We have over 300 members with about 1,300 locations statewide, as well as wholesale, distributors, and manufacturers. We are tasked to support and represent industry while advancing the common good of our great state. As one of the only industries that remained open from day one of the pandemic, this conversation is really important and has consequences. And we want to share with you some of the frontline realities that we experienced. This last year has been unprecedented for everyone, and none of us have ever experienced anything like it. Our multi-generational grocers were certainly flabbergasted on what happened to our stores. We work nonstop around the clock to bring food to the communities we serve. A supply chain had challenges, and as you heard from the Attorney General, there were challenges. We worked with resources that went above and beyond to bring food and necessities to our neighbors. As things broke down, we used restaurant supply, we used local, we used capacities that we hadn't used before to try to minimize those disruptions, but it did bring new challenges. Our customers experienced changes. For the first time in many of their lives, they were not getting the products that they were used to seeing. Things weren't available on the shelves, again, as you did hear the Attorney General, and I'm sure everyone here experienced. you couldn't possibly get that big roll of toilet paper that you got before. There were maybe single rolls. Things changed. People stopped in different, shopped in different stores. They brought different brands. Things that were price leaders couldn't be price leaders anymore. It was a very complex and confusing environment for customers. And the grocers were trying to navigate to the best of our ability. But none of this constituted price gouging. Yet that's not what we ended up experiencing. In March, when the Executive Order 2010 was issued and a subsequent media campaign began, the price gouging complaints poured into the AG's office. We had a fantastic working relationship with the AG's office, and we helped our members navigate because it was most important that they stayed on the floor and got food to the customers. The folks that were hit the hardest by these complaints, unfortunately, were our rural stores and our ethnic markets. There were some communication and understanding barriers. Our rural stores are single operators who actually are stocking the shelves, running the grocery cash registers, and doing the books, and they had the largest complaints and the largest problems. The price gouging became almost a point of contention between grocers and their customers, which was unfortunate in a time when there were so many pressures. They were tasked with providing over 6 weeks of invoices to prove they weren't price gouging in the middle of this crisis. They were working to stay open, meeting the needs of the community, and providing a safe environment to very, very fearful customers and employees. Just in one example, we saw eggs increase anywhere from 95% to 222% at retail, and that was pure increase that the retailer experienced. Many of the products we even tried to absorb as much as we could to help our customers. We worked at the AG office. As you heard, they saw over 2,400 complaints. Out of all of those, very few actually brought price gouging forward. Many of them were actually traced all the way back to farm, and so that's a whole nother complexity in how supply chain works. This is an exhaustive amount of paperwork and man hours for all involved. Again, in the middle of a crisis that we aren't knowing how to manage. Imagine being a mom and pop store with very few employees and you're pulling 6 weeks worth of invoices. The bill before you today is very well intended and we understand the purpose and the direction, but it does not lay all the foundation to address some of these complexities. It does bring forth still that confrontational for those that aren't price gouging. We do think there needs to be some kind of component for blatant retail overcharging. Unfortunately, there are better.
Ms. Poole, I apologize. We're on a tight schedule today. If you could wrap up, please.
We do know this disproportionately affects brick and mortar, and we hope to be part of a more in-depth conversation as this does move forward, making what's right for both customers, supply chain, farm to fork. Again, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and we look forward to working further with Chair Stevenson.
Thank you. Members, we will move to discussion. Do I have any questions or comments? Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the discussion today. I just had a couple questions, and I could direct it to the bill author, Representative Stevenson, or the AG's office if they'd prefer to answer. I was wondering if you could explain a little bit about how you thought about the 30% kind of cutoff. It's my understanding that the DE amendment makes it so that 30% or less is not considered a gross disparity. And then kind of in addition to that, I was wondering if you could, is there a definition of gross disparity that's easily understood by our retailers so that they kind of know what the rules of the game are when it comes to this new law?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Rasmussen, excellent questions. So the 30% safe harbor was an idea that was initially brought to me by the retailers, and I thought it was a very reasonable idea to have a safe harbor in the bill, because I think that retailers should, you know, and all participants in the economy should be able to have some certainty that know that by raising their price during a pandemic because of, you know, modest amounts or other factors, that they're not going to be subject to a price gouging investigation. And, you know, kind of for a lot of the reasons that Ms. Fool and the grocers just raised. Initially, you know, I was looking at a much smaller margin than 30%, but I, you know, had a great conversation with the retailers and others about that, and looked at going up to about 30%, because it's, you know, common to see the argument that ultimately persuaded me was it's common to see sale prices of 20 or 25% in the retail space. And so if you had the sort of, I don't know if you'd want to say misfortune or coincidence of ending a sale right as a disaster struck. You'd want some certainty that that ending the sale wouldn't expose you to some liability. So that's where that comes from. I do think it's important to recognize, as I've said all along, that the vast majority of people who operate Minnesota businesses want to do the right thing, don't want to hurt their friends and neighbors, want to be helpful during an emergency, right? And so we want to provide some certainty for those people that they aren't exposed to liability. Your second question about what, you know, constitutes a gross disparity. Well, that term is used in the definition of unconscionably excessive under the amended A4 definition. And it occurs when there is a big difference between the price before the emergency and during the emergency, as long, you know, in excess of that safe harbor amount, that 30%. And it also talks in that section about it not being substantially related to the increase in the cost of obtaining or selling the good or providing the service. So when we talk about the example of eggs that Ms. Fuel brought forward, you know, if a grocer is experiencing that price up the supply chain, that's excluded from a gross disparity and unconscionably excessive by the nature of the statute, right? We're not going to punish people for things that happen up the supply chain.
Thank you.
Sorry about that, Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Stevenson. Appreciate that. And you know, my concern is, you know, as kind of the grocer stated earlier, this is just going to put an undue burden on the retailers to basically have to prove that price increases came from other places in the supply chain. I have a lot of, you know, mom and pop independent grocers, retailers in the district that I represent, and I know that, as you said earlier, Representative Stevenson, you know, they all act in good faith, and their customers are not just their customers, but are their neighbors and their friends, and I worry about the undue burden that this would put on them. And then the other concern I have, you know, with the bill is, you know, one of the big issues that we all saw as a part of the pandemic, and unfortunately Texas has experienced with their weather crisis, is empty shelves. And I actually, you know, think that sometimes pricing can be a useful tool to head off hoarding behavior that we saw, you know, both during our pandemic and in others. And so I worry that this will, you know, prevent retailers and others in the supply chain from taking smart action that actually helps ensure that there is toilet paper, water bottles on the shelves, gasoline at the gas stations, to make sure that we can get critical resources to people during that time. I know there's other tools that can be used, but I worry that this could lead to actually more empty shelves and not fewer empty shelves. Last follow-up question I had, Madam Chair, was on, you know, does this bill, you know, touch on all retailers? Would it affect Amazon, eBay, you know, gas suppliers, or is this really focused on kind of our brick-and-mortar Minnesota retailers?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Rasmussen, I don't believe there's any limitation on whether it's brick and mortar or otherwise. A seller as defined under the bill is broadly defined and doesn't contain a limitation that would apply only to brick and mortar. If I could just take a minute though and say that, you know, I do worry about undue burden upon businesses, and I think that we've made an effort to accommodate that when we talk about the safe harbor and other provisions. But I really, with respect, I have to say that the undue burden that I'm most concerned about are the people who aren't going to be able to get food and water during an emergency because the prices are ridiculous and out of control. And that, I think, should be our primary focus, is making sure that people have the essential goods and services they need to survive in a pandemic or an emergency. You know, when people are profiting, charging $1,000 a night for a hotel room, that's just wrong. It's just wrong, and that's the undue burden that we should be focused on with respect. I mean, we need to have accommodation for business, the needs of businesses, but what we really also need to be focused on is how people survive in these circumstances. And I just have to disagree with your idea that high prices are a way to manage supply. You know, the idea that people who have means should have greater access to goods and services during an emergency than people without, I just take strong exception to that. everyone deserves the opportunity to keep their family safe in an emergency like that, not just rich people who can afford high prices.
Representative Lees, next.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Stevenson, for bringing this forward. I have a question for the Attorney General, just trying to understand the process. For the Attorney General's office, what do you have right now in place for those communities that may be limited English speakers if they wanted to report a potential violation of this going forward? And do you have the resources necessary to be able to communicate with our community members that don't speak English as a first language?
Mr. Plagenkuhl, or perhaps, I'm not sure who wants to take that, please.
This is Assistant AG Eric Maloney. I'm happy to field that. Thank you, Chair and Representative Lee. So this is actually an issue we've thought a lot about, both in our price gouging work and just kind of in our general interaction with the community for our more typical consumer complaints. So we have kind of two different things that we put in place. I know in the phone room we have some people who can handle phone calls that are multilingual, and they can handle, I think, a pretty wide variety of languages. We also put out a lot of our publications in multiple languages. And I know for complaint forms, we do have some forms, although not all, and I think we're kind of working to beef up the different forms that we have, but I know we have forms that are available for consumers in multiple languages. So it's definitely something that we're thinking about and trying to make sure that we can hear from as much of the community as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Maloney. Representative Lee?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that too. And I would just, you know, encourage members of the committee and for the legislature for us to, you know, really consider our the Minnesotans out there that, you know, may fall prey to some of these practices. Just because of their ability to speak a certain language or not, and for us to really think about the resources that we could provide for the Attorney General and the agencies that are charged with protecting our consumers in the state. So thank you, Chair Stevenson, for bringing this forward.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the bill author, Representative Stevenson. I tell you, I know what you're trying to do here, and I think it's a very noble idea. But I also am concerned about the spread of additional unintended consequences. And first of all, I'd like to say that if you happen to be a smaller community across the state of Minnesota, you have a grocery store, a hardware store, or other type of retail establishment, many of the school districts, many of the cities try to do business with those retailers in the community because they are the ones who pay the taxes to support those local municipal services and school services. They oftentimes have contracts to provide fuel. They have contracts to provide food for childcare programs and before school and after school lunch programs. And when a pandemic or an emergency or an unforeseen disaster, thus by the name disaster, occurs, they don't have the ability on a dime to be able to spin and to be able to fulfill all of their obligations potentially to their contracted parties as well as the general public. And I have experienced in past disasters where the community has reached out through local government to partner with hotels once they identify who has lost housing? What type of housing isn't there? What my question is, how do we protect those very valuable and limited resources in your bill where people who may not have been first in line to be able to acquire that under your plan, how do we take care of the rest of those people, the folks who are displaced? How do we even know that those hotels are going to be safe to be able to put people there? By putting the pricing in place, it buys some time to be able to make sure that we have prioritization of food services, retailing services, as well as accommodations during disasters. I will have some more follow-ups, but I think we'll just start with that. If Representative Stevenson could comment about how he anticipates the bill to deal with those kinds of things.
Chair Stevenson, care to respond?
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, you know, when you talk about prioritization, you're talking about prioritization by ability to pay. And you shouldn't have to depend upon protecting your family to be to have abnormal means to be able to afford $1,000 a night hotel room because it's the only place where there's electricity and the person who operates it is trying to make a buck. You know, that shouldn't be how we make these decisions. This bill is not an end all be all. It's not the complete guide document to how we're going to handle disasters and emergencies. And as I said at the beginning, you know, I believe and I know from my own experience that across Minnesota, not just in our small towns, but in our suburbs and in our large urban centers, most Minnesotans try to take care of one another during hard times. We see that all the time. They try to do the right thing. We're talking about a few bad actors and holding them accountable for behavior that I think we all would agree is reprehensible. That's what this bill is about.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
The bill author continues to grab onto a nice soundbite, which is $1,000 for a hotel room and priority to be able to get those by being one's economic wealth. What about holding those assets from anyone? Because that's maybe what the proprietor would do. And then are we going to have a bill in a couple of years that because of the disaster, we have to require these places to be open to do retailing, to make their services available? There is a certain sense of when there's an emergency situation or disaster that things tend to whipsaw for a reason until we can figure out what is happening and where things are going. We see that in the marketplace all the time. We see that in the stock market.
Chair Stevenson.
I'll take you back to the March of last year. We're almost on the 52nd week anniversary of the 2-week anniversary of needing to shut the state of Minnesota down because of the pandemic. The markets had fallen precipitously. What did they do once the markets found equilibrium again? The markets were back and people were restored. Some haven't regained their wealth yet as a result of that, but this is what happens in these situations. I see it kind of disingenuous where you're putting one industry, the hotel industry. What about the children who aren't going to be able to get food in those programs from the grocery store because they're putting the products out on the shelf, or others are they're closing down, or there's looting that takes place because these businesses are trying to figure out and assess what their obligations are to other customers within a marketplace, which could be helping the very same people that you say this bill is trying to help. I find it kind of interesting. Madam Chair, if Representative Stevenson could respond to that. And I do have one other follow-up that I need to talk to the bill author about.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Chair Stevenson.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I'm kind of incredulous that you think that the solution to the possibility of shortages during a pandemic and you even raise the specter of looting is price gouging, is having enormously high prices. You know, that is not the way that we want to decide who has food, water, and essential services during an emergency, I don't think. It's just incredible to me that would be the suggestion. What this bill is about is very narrowly targeting people who are engaged in behavior that no one, I think, can defend, which is trying to profit off the misery and desperation of other people. And it's just incredible to me that your suggestion is that the solution to shortages or other things that happen during these disasters would be price gouging and profiteering.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not going to say that the chair is impugning my motive on this, but by saying that my desire to deal with this is price gouging, I'm simply talking about basic economics, about supply and demand. When we have a disaster that occurs, first responders go to those disasters and try to assess and triage the situation, and they prioritize what the needs are going to be. And if there isn't adequate resources within that community because they have been already used in other ways, not only are you disadvantaging the people that they're trying to support and triage through public services, you're also affecting other people who are not able to get this the supplies and prioritizing those. Markets have reactions. I'm sure you've taken a few economics classes in your time, Representative Stevenson, as a result of that. Executive Order 2010 appears to have done the job that's necessary, and there are no two disasters that are identical. And to try to put in place something that's going to be an end-all be-all for all disasters is somewhat problematic. Madam Chair, my follow-up and final at this point, depending upon how the question is answered, may have a follow-up. I understand that we're going to be sending this bill to the General Register, and there are civil fines that are in here. Is there a change in House rules where the Civil Law Committee would not be seeing civil fines and having to weigh in on that? Have I missed something in our rules this year?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, we did make some changes to automatic referrals in the House rules this year. The referral to civil law is a permissive referral. We did check with the chair of the Civil Law Committee, who indicated that a hearing in that committee, in judiciary and civil law in that committee, was not necessary.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, I look forward to a protracted debate and discussion on the House floor regarding civil fines, since we have for maybe perhaps for pandemic reasons, gouged out some of the committee processes or cut them out to try to expedite legislation this year. Gee, disasters do call for special considerations, Representative Stevenson. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Chair Stevenson, if you would, I have a quick question, and I'm sure that in considering this legislation and the proposal and all the conversations that you had with the various retailers and the Attorney General, I'm curious how this proposal relates or it kind of reflects some of the other 35 states that already have this legislation in place.
Thank you for the question, Madam Chair. As I kind of alluded to in my opening, other states take much tougher approaches. This is a compromise measure. When I mentioned earlier, fines in Texas for price gouging can be $250,000, much more severe than what we're talking about here in Minnesota. When you have 35 states, there's multitude of different approaches in those states, but I really think that ours is a reasonable, thoughtful compromise approach.
Thank you for that. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, the bill author. The question I would have is, back when I was a truck driver and I was driving the day that 9/11 happened. And I remember that night when I was making my deliveries, when I was going to the gas stations, the price of gasoline jumped from my $1.15, $1.30-ish to some gas stations, it went to over $3. Some gas stations I saw that night, that very night, over $6 up in Forest Lake, if I remember. And it was in St. Paul. Actually, it was the Holiday gas station store right next to the Capitol on Rice Street there that we're all familiar with. That was the one where I had to wait to make my delivery in a long line of cars to even get into the parking lot because they'd all lined up. And it's my understanding that your bill defines an essential good as fuel, and that what is it defined as in terms of an increase, 30% over a 7-day period? Well, it was triple that. It would have been a 300% increase, right, to $3 at the Holiday store in St. Paul there. If that did not happen, that was not an example of somebody trying to gouge or take advantage of misery, as it's been characterized. It wasn't bad actors trying to profit. It was simply a response to market forces. And I'm concerned that if that were not allowed to happen, people would come in even at that price. Now, today, $2.50, $3 doesn't seem like a lot, but if you can put ourselves back 20 years, when we saw $3 gasoline was unheard of. And so if that were not allowed to happen, I'm very concerned that more people would have come and it would have exhausted the supply much faster. So if the government is going to interfere with market forces, natural supply and demand curves, what's going to happen is the supply is going to exhaust so much faster, and then nobody will have anything. So my concern is I think it's short-sighted to interfere under the intentions that we don't want to, we're assuming that when prices rise, it's bad actors trying to profit from misery, when in fact again, it's a healthy way of ensuring that supply does not exhaust too quickly. So just a concern, not necessarily a question, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Stevenson, if you'd like to respond to Representative Lucero, and then I think we're going to move to a vote.
I'll just make my closing comments and respond to Representative Lucero while I'm closing. I think that there's a misunderstanding that Representative Lucero has of the bill, and then a fundamental philosophical difference that I think has been shown throughout the hearing between, you know, the comments that some of the members of the minority have made here. The misunderstanding is that the bill pretty clearly articulates that normal supply issues that are happening up the chain are not price gouging, right? There's a language in there, it's not substantially related to an increase in the cost of obtaining or selling the good or providing the service. So if someone up the food chain, the supply chain breaks down and the cost of delivering the service or the good actually goes up, that's not price gouging, it's not impacted by this. We really are looking just at profiteering. So that's just a misunderstanding. But the fundamental difference in philosophy here is that there are people on this committee suggesting that's just fine, that the way we should ration supplies during emergency is on an ability to pay basis, and that your ability to provide food, water, housing, essential things for your family during emergency, it's fine for that to depend on if you have enough cash in the account to pay exorbitant prices, and it's fine if certain people profit off that. I don't think that's fine, and I don't think most Minnesotans think that's fine. I don't think Minnesotans think that we should be profiting off of disasters and misfortune and despair. That's not the way that we operate as a state. This bill narrowly targets bad actors, and I think that's appropriate. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll ask the committee for its support. And I renew my motion to place House File 844 on the general register.
Thank you. Chair Stevenson renews the motion that House File 844, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. And the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cortizo Watoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Dabney. Representative Elkins. Representative Haley.
No.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Representative Tice.
All right, thanks, Gavin.
No.
Representative Dabney. Representative Elkins.
There being 8 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 844, as amended, is being recommended to be placed on the general register. And I will go ahead and hand the virtual gavel back to Chair Stevenson.
Thank you for that great discussion, members of the committee. We will now move on to our next bill on the agenda, which is House File 1412. Representative Morrison, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 1412 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy, and invite Representative Morrison to describe her bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I'm pleased to present House File 1412, which is the Minnesota Telehealth Act. Telehealth is not new. The existing Telemedicine Act was passed in 2015 with broad bipartisan support, and the modality has been used effectively. But there's no doubt that a silver lining of the COVID-19 pandemic has been the greatly increased use of telehealth and telephone visits to provide patient care. Use of telehealth went from less than 2% of visits in 2019 to nearly 30% of visits in June of 2020, according to the Minnesota Medical Association survey that should be in your packets. It has helped people receive care during the pandemic, and many have recognized the advantages that this option creates for patients, expanding access to underserved communities, increasing convenience, and saving patients time and money. Let me highlight several important points about the bill. One, the bill uses the term telehealth instead of telemedicine. This is a much broader term that reflects how these services are being used. Much of the bill is rewriting existing law that uses the term telemedicine and changes it to telehealth. Two, it redefines originating site to allow services to be provided where the patient is located, including the patient's home. It meets patients where they are. Number three, the bill removes an arbitrary limit of 3 telehealth visits per week that exists for medical assistants and enrollees. 4, it includes telephone-only services in the definition of telehealth if those services are a part of a scheduled patient appointment and a standard of care for the service can be met through audio-only communication. 5, I do have an author's amendment that I can just touch on here. We can move that after, but it includes coverage for remote telemonitoring services for patients with conditions where that is medically appropriate. I think it's important to note that nothing in the bill requires patients or providers to use telehealth. The provider has the right and the responsibility to determine if telehealth is appropriate, and a patient has the right to choose not to receive care through telehealth. And two final points about which you may hear concerns are a prohibition on telehealth-only networks and a requirement for payment parity for telehealth. The bill prohibits the creation of a separate telehealth-only network that doesn't include in-person providers. Telehealth is intended to supplement in-person care, not entirely replace it. At best, 20 to 30% of care is provided via telehealth now. It cannot provide care for all services, obviously, and to allow insurers to offer a telehealth-only network will leave patients without the coverage that they need. It also requires insurers to reimburse a provider for services based through telehealth on the same basis and at the same rate as they would have provided in person. Many have talked about the greater efficiency of telehealth. Those efficiencies are mostly for the patient. The costs of providing the care, the practitioner's time, the electronic health record costs, the scheduling and billing staff, those exist whether the service is in person or through telehealth. Telehealth does not eliminate in-person care and the costs of maintaining a physical clinic, such as rent, utilities, and nursing staff. We've learned many things over the past year, and one of them is the positive addition of telehealth services to the healthcare toolbox. As we confront the healthcare disparities that exist by race, geography, and economic status, as well as the mental health and substance use disorder crises that we face in Minnesota, telehealth is an important modality to help tackle them. And Mr. Chair, I have, I believe, 3 testifiers, 2 physicians, and a patient.
Excellent. Should we do the amendment real quick that you alluded to? You have an author's amendment. It's the A1. I'll move the A1 to get the bill in the shape you'd like the committee to consider it. I think you already described it. Any discussion to the A1? Representative Haley, do you have a question about the A1?
No, Mr. Chair, can wait.
Okay. Any discussion to the A1? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The motion prevails and the A1 is adopted. We'll move on to the testifiers. We do have a number and we're, as I mentioned, running short on time, so I'm gonna have to ask all the testifiers to limit their remarks to 2 minutes. The first testifier is Dr. Kim Jaden.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much. I'm Kim Jaden. I'm a family doctor in St. Cloud. I'm here representing the Minnesota Medical Association in strong support of HF 1412. During COVID-19, the governor's executive order allowed for expanded use of telehealth, which has been critical for my patients to receive the care that they need. Without this bill, these expansions will expire in June. Telehealth is not a substitute for inpatient care. While some care must be provided face-to-face, I can still provide quality needed care to my patients over the internet and the telephone. Video visits are not accessible to all in our state due to weak broadband, technology illiteracy, and the cost of technology. There are many patients I serve who cannot afford the equipment needed for video visits. I've seen firsthand how telephone-only visits are necessary to address obstacles to care. Without continued coverage of telephone-only visits, many of my patients would have a difficult time accessing healthcare and may go without. Some have argued the quality of care delivered during a telehealth visit cannot be the same as the quality of an in-person visit, but research tells us differently. In July, the Medical Association conducted a survey where 84% of physicians reported telehealth service was meeting the needs of our patients, and more importantly, 83% of patients said that they liked it and were satisfied with their visits. Telehealth does not reduce the requirement to provide quality care, and it does not change my duty to my patients. Current law requires insurers pay the same reimbursement for services, whether in person or telehealth. HF 1412 maintains that law. The care provided via telehealth is the same. The staffing, the scheduling, the electronic health record costs are all the same. We cannot allow insurers to use this bill to reduce payments. You need to know the positive impact of telehealth services on patients, particularly those in rural and underserved areas. Without the ability to use telehealth from their homes or to have a telephone-only visit, many of my patients would be forced to forego treatment. I ask you to support HF 1412. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Jaden. The next testifier is Dr. Sarah Manny.
Thank you, Chairman Stevenson and committee members, for this opportunity to weigh in on this important issue for healthcare in Minnesota. My name is Dr. Sarah Manny, and I serve as Essentia Health's Chief Medical Information Officer, and I maintain a pediatric practice in Duluth. On behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association and Essentia Health, I respectfully request your support of House File 1412. Along with the Minnesota Hospital Association and other providers and stakeholders that you'll hear from today, Essentia Health urges this body to continue to allow providers to deliver services directly from a patient's residence, whether these services are provided over a telephone, tablet, laptop, or personal computer. Essentia Health is an integrated health system serving patients in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and North Dakota. Headquartered in Duluth, Minnesota, we have over 13,300 employees who serve patients and communities through our 13 hospitals, 69 clinics, and 6 long-term care facilities. Since March 2020, Essentia Health has conducted approximately 389,000 virtual visits directly to patients, with almost 40% of these visits being offered over the telephone. During this time, these virtual visits have allowed Essentia Health to conduct over 80% of its mental health encounters, avoid countless ER visits, and save patients' lives. While the number of virtual visits has leveled off since the early months of the pandemic, virtual visits still account for roughly 20% of Essentia's encounters and will remain an important tool ensuring access to care throughout the rural and underserved communities we are privileged to serve. As a pediatrician, I have experienced the overwhelming benefits of virtual visits firsthand, and I'd like to share two stories with you. My very first virtual visit that I did was a follow-up hospitalization visit with an infant and the mother. And as I was talking with the mother and she was sharing the video with me and I could observe the child, it was very clear to me that the child was deteriorating over the last several hours. I truly believe that this technology saved her life. If she were to have driven into my office, gone up into my office, and was transported to the emergency room, I feel the outcome could have been drastically different. Instead, I was able to skip those steps and get her safely to a higher level of care, and she's doing well today.
Dr. Manny, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up your testimony.
Thank you. I also provided mental health services to a child in rural Minnesota, and I think it's really important how this has saved time in both the family and in the patient. So please, thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Dr. Manny. Our next testifier is Serenity Bohuniak. Ms. Bohuniak.
Hello. Okay. Hello, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Serenity Bohuniak. I live in Northeast Minneapolis. I am 15 years old and I attend Edison High School. I am here to talk to you today about telemedicine. I have JIA, which is short for juvenile idiopathic arthritis, which is mostly known as rheumatoid arthritis in adults. I also have depression and anxiety. I'm going to share with you a little bit about how telehealth helped me get treatment. I had recently moved to Minnesota this summer. With transferring doctors, it was very hectic, and telehealth got me connected with all my doctors and get all the medicines I needed, which was harder with my condition. Telemedicine made it easier with transportation because not all kids and families have enough vehicles. Many families have only one vehicle that is not available while the main caretaker has the car. In my family, we have one vehicle for six people, so driving to appointments in the middle of the day was a challenge. Telemedicine also made it easier to communicate with people. People like myself with anxiety have a harder time communicating and opening up to someone new, like a doctor in a clinic, especially when I am not in a familiar place. It's less stressful and not as intimidating to be at home. I was able to do appointments in my bedroom and my comfort spot with my cat. People with anxiety can get really stressed, and being with my pet calmed me down. Telemedicine also makes it easier and safer for patients with a lower immune system like I do, especially this time of year. Even when there's no COVID, going to the doctor increases my risk of getting sick. I urge you to pass this legislation. Thank you to the committee and the representative Morrison for bringing this up.
Thank you very much for sharing your story and your courage and bravery for telling it with this committee. Really, really appreciate it. The next testifier is Dan Andreessen from the Council of Health Plans. Mr. Andreessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. The delivery of healthcare has changed since the legislature last debated telehealth policy 6 years ago. Technology has advanced, providers have adopted the technology, and patients have access to care at a time and a place that works for them. I want to be clear, the council fully supports the ongoing use and expansion of telehealth for all Minnesotans. Our nonprofit members have supported access to telehealth since 2015, during the COVID-19 pandemic and beyond. The council supports most of the language in House File 1412, but is opposed to language regarding continuing payment parity and placing restrictions on the creation of virtual networks. As was mentioned, parity is current law, and telephone parity was temporarily extended in 2020 session law because of the pandemic. The council supported these changes to ensure patients could maintain access to providers and providers could still see patients to stay financially afloat. The council is not advocating for any changes during the peacetime emergency, but as we emerge from the pandemic, we need to take an honest look at parity and the overall cost of telehealth. When we debate healthcare issues, we hear that healthcare is expensive, the cost of care continues to go up, and that everyone agrees we need to do something about these costs. These costs are paid by Minnesotans through out-of-pocket costs for services, health insurance premiums, and taxes for state public programs. It's not easy to find policies that can bend the cost curve, but telehealth has that potential. We agree providers should be paid for their expertise. It's also likely these overall costs to provide care through a phone call or video is less when a person's in a clinic. We believe any savings from telehealth should be passed back to the consumer in the form of lower costs. It's important to note, moving away from parity does not necessarily mean paying providers less for telehealth services. It could be less, it could be pet parity, or payment could be increased when tied to quality and outcomes. These are decisions that should be made between the payers and providers for what's best for their patients. The council supports legislation that finds long-term solutions to address healthcare costs and what's best for patients. Thank you.
The next testifier is Bentley Graves from the Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Graves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I want to thank Representative Morrison for her work thus far on this bill and for the engagement around a number of the issues in the bill that we've been able to talk with her about. And the amendment today reflects some of the input that we've already been able to have on the language, and we very much appreciate that as it relates to tightening up the language around scheduled telephone calls and as it relates to remote patient monitoring. Telehealth is an important issue for our members. In surveying our members this summer and fall, we found that a significant number of them are placing an even greater emphasis on telehealth as it relates to the health benefits that they offer their employees, both in response to access issues as related to the pandemic, but also for the hope for cost savings that may come with it. And while there is a lot of good work, as I mentioned, that's been done on the bill thus far, there are some areas of the bill that we'd like to continue to work with the author and the other stakeholders on. We were very involved in 2015 in the legislature's passage of the telehealth bill then and the parity piece of it. We're not looking to relitigate that discussion or relitigate that debate, but as Mr. Andreessen said, you know, we do believe that there are aspects of the healthcare system and the healthcare landscape that are fundamentally different now. Chief among those has been a growth and hopeful continued growth of value-based payment arrangements away from fee-for-service and centered on outcomes for patients. that that we and I think many others believe, you know, really can play a role in curbing the growth of costs in the healthcare system. So our hope is that as this bill moves forward, we can find a way to ensure that that those arrangements can continue and are not kind of thwarted by the parity piece that's been in place for a number of years. And similarly, we have some additional discussion we'd like to have around the bill's language on virtual networks. I understand Representative Morrison's point about access to in-person care, but we have seen a lot of innovative plan design in other parts of the country really leveraging access to care virtually. That not only improves the access, but has been delivered in plan designs that have offered care and coverage at a much lower price point. So we appreciate that, and we'll look forward to continuing to work with the author and the other stakeholders. And Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. The last testifier is Jessica Young from Medical Alley. Ms. Young.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jessica Young, and I am a policy and advocacy manager at the Medical Alley Association. We are the cross-sector healthcare association in Minnesota that supports and advances Medical Alley's global leadership in health innovation and care. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House File 1412. We want to thank Representative Morrison for her leadership on this issue, and we look forward to working with the authors and stakeholders as the bill moves along in the process. First, we would like to thank the author for substituting the word telehealth for telemedicine. This is an important update in terminology that more accurately reflects the reality of virtual care delivery. We appreciate the expanded definition of originating site to the location of the patient when they are provided telehealth. We are also thankful for the inclusion of telemonitoring, as clarity on the coverage of telemonitoring is a significant priority for both our members and their patients. Both of these changes will be beneficial to patients as they will allow them to access quality, clinically appropriate care safely from where they are located. We appreciate the modification to the definition of telehealth that the author has included in the bill. We do, however, believe that the definition of telehealth outlined in House File 1411 may be a better approach. We support the addition of language clarifying that value-based arrangements or payment models are not bound by the payment parity portion of this legislation. It is important to provide clarity to plans, providers, and innovators that these types of forward-looking care models can operate in a way that makes the most sense for patients. We do have concerns with the language in the bill that limits a patient's ability to access health networks that do not include network providers who provide in-person care for the same service. This language could inhibit the development of innovative care models or other care plans that are able to deliver high-quality care for a lower cost in certain situations. Medical Alley Association, on behalf of our over 600 members, looks forward to continuing conversations with the bill author on this legislation. And thank you again to Representative Morrison for bringing the bill forward today. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now move on to member discussion and questions. I'd like to move to a vote in about 10 minutes. There's five members on the list, so if each member could try and keep their questions and comments to about 2 minutes, we should be doing great. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Morrison, for bringing the bill forward. I'm very excited about this bill, and I won't repeat all the positives that the other testifiers have stated. This could be one of the best things to come out of COVID is the advancement in telehealth and the advancement for patients just all over our state. I represent a rural part of the state, and healthcare is very important to my constituents and has been an area that I've focused on quite a bit during my legislative career. And I've always said my goal is to make sure that we had access to quality care at a price that we could afford close to home. And telehealth gives us, it can help us reach all three of those goals simultaneously. So I just want to call out Representative Morrison. I would love to vote for your bill today. I will be voting no. And I just want to do that to encourage you to continue to work on it. And I'm happy to be a part of that discussion. My main concern is that cost of care close to home, the cost piece. My area of the state pays the highest individual insurance costs in the entire state. And telehealth can help us reduce those costs. So I think we need to continue to have this discussion around parity. And today, you know, in my vote, I can't accept that telehealth doesn't have some cost advantages that can be passed on to the consumer. I'm sure we have great healthcare metrics that the providers have and also the insurers have, that we can take a look at as telehealth advances. And I would ask that we look at potentially a sunset on your parity language. I'm pleased that I think there's a lot of agreement again on the benefits of telehealth and that our need to extend this flexibility outside of the EO. And I'm glad that we're doing that work. It's work we should be doing, but potentially a sunset on the parity is a good idea because we have to continue to allow the space for innovation and the discussion and the innovation around value-based care. And I'm concerned that your parity language would stifle that. Thank you very much, Representative Morrison, and thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll underscore Representative Haley's comments. Representative Morrison, I very much appreciate your bipartisan work on this bill. And there's a lot of good things that help move Minnesota forward into the future when it comes to healthcare. And so thank you for your thoughtful work on this and your perspective as a provider. I also share Representative Haley's concerns that this bill basically doubles down and ensures that those cost savings that could be realized through telehealth won't get passed on to consumers, especially many of my constituents who are on high deductible health plans. And so Representative Morrison, first question for you is, do you have a sense of when parity could go away? I understand the startup costs, especially for small rural providers for investing in telehealth infrastructure. I just talked to a local hospital administrator this morning on that topic. But do you have a sense of when it would make sense to sunset the parity requirements so we can pass on the savings to patients and actually bring down the cost of healthcare?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Rasmussen and Representative Haley, for your comments. I appreciate both of your perspective. And, I guess I think where this bill is coming from is we're seeing it not as this is just a different way of doing the same services. So the cost savings are realized by the patients. And so this is the beginning of the conversation, and I am very willing to engage with all who have an opinion and a stake in this conversation. But I guess I would just redirect it toward the patient, because this is with patients in mind, this is about expanding care. I don't know that this is where we're going to save money in healthcare.
Representative Rasmussen, if you have a brief follow-up, allow, but we have very limited time.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick follow-up, Representative Morrison. I had a kind of a personal story where I had, this wasn't a Minnesota provider, but had a test done. And, instead of just getting the voicemail, call I would have gotten 10 years ago hear my test results, the provider made me basically go through a telehealth app, and then I got a $300 bill for it. And I've heard those instances from other Minnesotans as well. And so I was wondering, Representative Morrison, if you could speak to any consumer protections you have in here for the patients to make sure that, some of the providers, are acting in good faith. I know 99.9% of providers will, and they want to do right by their patient. But what consumer protections do we have to make sure that, billing for essentially new services don't happen?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Rasmussen. And I really think we did address a lot of that in our conversations, and I thank the Chamber and Mr. Graves for his suggestions in that area, where we really have specified that there has to be a scheduled telephone appointment, and giving lab results would not be included unless it was a more involved situation. This is not creating new things. This is just a different way of providing the same services.
Representative Lissard, before we call on you, though, I just want to remind members that I'm asking people to try and keep it to 2 minutes. We aren't doing so good so far. I know, Representative Lucero, I know that you will be a good example for the rest of the committee, though. So, Representative Lucero.
And on that note, Mr. Chair, I will change my comments from questions to just that comment. And so a couple comments here. I, in the advent of COVID here with distance learning, I actually prefer just some consideration for the bill author, something like distance healthcare or distance medicine or something like that, rather than telemedicine, because voice and data communications are actually how most of this stuff traverses the network. But a couple other thoughts here. Back when I used to work in the earlier part of last decade, when I worked at Medica, there was a fascinating room, an innovation room on the first floor called the Hospital Room of the Future. And back in the earlier part of last decade, if you remember, we're all used to touch screen and surface type technology now, but back when it was just on the forefront, it wasn't as prevalent. You go through and there was all kinds of innovation stuff that was on the horizon of the future. And I am very excited for what these future innovations continue to hold for us. And on that note, because I'm interested in innovation, and as we think about the internet in its infancy, the conversation in the early part of the 2000s was we don't want to impose regulation or taxes or things like that because it might stifle the innovation that would occur or that has occurred over the last 20 years in the technology space. I want that same thing to happen, so I'm just concerned about some of the mandates that we might put on there. And one in particular here I'm looking at, it is subdivision 3, section, well, it's line 2.28. There's a provision against providing incentives. And I remember here just last year, I think it was, that I was incentivized to get a renewal of my referral for acupuncture, of all things. And I did so over a call like this. And I was incentivized because I didn't have to pay the copay. I didn't have to pay the $35. So in your language here, I'm concerned that why shouldn't we incentivize consumers to engage in the behavior of remote or distance medicine? And then when it comes to, I guess I didn't cover that already. So one last thing would be on the topic of innovation. Think of the mini clinics, right, in the Cub Foods and other things. There are those providers that have, they recognize there's some service delivery that has to happen in person, and then there's others that can be remote and doesn't need to be physically in person. And one area we've seen that are these mini clinics. I envision that there will be providers that can offer services that are remote only, and they shouldn't, and they should be incentivized and allowed to innovate at lower costs and then therefore be reimbursed at lower costs. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Morrison. I am going to be a no, but I'm definitely excited as the conversations continue. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I just wanted to let folks know that this was telemedicine was one of the priorities of the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council. We found that people are able to better participate in recovery and treatment when they have access. And then I just had a question. What was your job title at Medica?
That, I believe, was directed to Representative Lucero.
Mr. Chair, I actually misspoke. It wasn't Medica. It was Medtronic. I just was thinking about that. It was Medtronic that I worked at. But I also did work at Medica, just at a different time frame.
That's a twofer. He didn't say what his job title was either, though.
Sorry, the job title at the time was Senior IT Security Analyst.
Got it.
Okay, thank you. Got it. All right. Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Morrison, for bringing this bill forward. I know throughout the pandemic, many insurance companies did waive those copays, like Representative Lucero had just alluded to, and I don't know if the majority of them are still offering that for telehealth services or what the situation is, but, you know, I, as you know, delivered a baby over the interim, and so, you know, on the payment sheet, there's like a facilities fee, and then there's a physician fee or a non-facilities fee, and so I guess I would echo Representative Rasmussen and Representative Haley's concerns about like the ongoing parity, just because, you know, I mean, if somebody has to go in just for a regular doctor's visit, if they use Kleenex in the room, if they, you know, if another physician is able to work from home and they're not, they're able to see patients online via telehealth, but then other physicians are able to see additional patients on site, what may be able to be worked out there, because I do think that that would be really powerful should those costs be able to be passed along, or those savings be able to be passed along to the patients. And I appreciate your consideration and all your work.
All right. Representative Morrison, do you have any brief closing comments before we vote?
I'll be very brief. I appreciate the discussion. And I do just want to remind everyone, and when we're talking about the concerns about the growth of the cost of healthcare, this is a way for us to increase access to primary care and preventive medicine, which in the long run will save us money. So I just want to ground us back into the patient being the center of this conversation. Thank you for the discussion. I look forward to ongoing conversation and work on this bill. And I urge everyone to
Thank you, Representative Morrison. I will renew the motion that House File 1412, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. Mr. Brown will take the roll, and I vote aye.
Vice Chair Katizo-Watun.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Dabney.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
No.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Thank you. Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Representative Tice.
No.
There being 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 1412, as amended, is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. I misspoke. 11 ayes and 6 nays. Same result. We will now move to the next item on the agenda, which is House File 269, also a Representative Morrison bill. I will move that House File 269 be recommended to be re-referred. I have to the Committee on Ways and Means, but I think after the amendment, it actually goes to the General Register. Is that right, Representative Morrison?
That's yeah. Correct,
Mr. Chair. So I will move that be placed on the General Register and ask Representative Morrison to describe the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 269 is a bill to allow Minnesota to join the Psychology Interjurisdictional Compact, or PSIPACT, which is an interstate compact that facilitates the practice of psychology using telecommunications technologies and or temporary face-to-face psychological practice. The benefits of PSIPACT, just briefly, include increasing access to care by providing services to populations that are currently underserved or geographically isolated, facilitating continuity of care when a patient relocates or travels. It also certifies that psychologists have met acceptable standards of practice, of course. It promotes cooperation among PSIPACT states in the areas of regulation and licensure. It offers a higher degree of consumer protection across state lines. And it decreases logistical burden on psychologists by allowing licensed psychologists to practice telepsychology and or conduct temporary in-person face-to-face practice across state lines without having to become licensed in additional PSIPACT states. So far, 16 states have joined PSIPACT, and I believe 12 others have pending legislation. This bill has bipartisan support, and I particularly want to thank Senator Benson for carrying the bill in the Senate. I believe I have, if you will allow me, Mr. Chair, a testifier or two. And I do have those amendments as well.
All right. Why don't we take the amendments first, if that's all right. I believe there are two authors' amendments. The first is the A6 amendment. I will move the A6 amendment. Representative Morrison, do you want to describe quickly what that amendment does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A6 amendment deletes the fiscal note because there is no cost to the state. The minimal cost will be covered by the Board of Psychology.
Okay. Any discussion to the A6? Representative O'Driscoll, did you have a comment on A6 or A7? Or A5, I mean.
Representative Morrison answered my question as to why it wouldn't be going to Ways and Means. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further discussion to the A6? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. There's a second author's amendment. It's the A5. I will move the A5 and ask Representative Morrison to describe the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A5 amendment provides clarity around liability of the PSIPACT commission.
And there is a testifier to the A5 amendment, Mr. Joel Carlson from the Association for Justice. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Good morning. I'm Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. When this bill was heard in judiciary, we raised several issues that intersect with the Judiciary and Commerce Committee as it relates to insurance and liability. I appreciate the efforts of the chair and Representative Morrison to bring the A5 amendment forward. It makes clear that the liability for this commission would be the same as any other governmental entity in Minnesota, which is they have responsibility for the acts of their employees, officers, and agents. I've been greatly educated on other portions of the bill that we raised some issues about. I appreciate this amendment very much. Would ask for members' support and appreciate the concept of this bill that that can help people gain greater access to mental health care that they need. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carlson. Any further discussion to the A5? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails and the A5 amendment is adopted. There is a testifier to the bill, Dr. Trisha Stark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. CIPACT is the national standard for providing safe psychological services across state lines using telehealth. All psychologists practicing through CIPACT must be aware of local resources should an emergency arise, be culturally competent to provide care to the specific population they are serving, attest to being knowledgeable about the laws of the state in which they are practicing, and have no history of any kind of disciplinary action. Such standards are crucial to the protections of Minnesotans. Please support CIPACT because it enables continuity of care and increases access to care while protecting the public with the highest national standards.
Thank you, Dr. Stark. Any discussion to House File 269? Seeing no discussion to House File 269, I'm going to have to change my motion. We did get word from Ways and Means during the course of the hearing that they still would like to see the bill because the cost is being absorbed. So I will amend my motion to be that House File 269, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, and Mr. Brown will take the roll, and the chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Cotizza-Watoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Dabney.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley. Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Aye.
Representative Lilly.
Aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Aye.
Representative Lucero. Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Representative Tice.
No.
Representative Haley.
Yes.
Representative Lucero.
There being 13 ayes and 3 nays, the motion prevails in House File 260, I'm sorry, I got distracted. 269 as amended is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Morrison. We have two bills left on the agenda, but I think we're just gonna bring up 648, which has already been heard in this committee. We're going to bring it back because there's been discussion, and I'd like to try and get it out today because it does have two additional committee stops. So I understand we're pressed for time, but I'd like to try to get it through since we've already heard this bill once before. So Representative Cagle, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move that House File 648. Is that the right one?
Yep.
Sent to Human Services?
Health, Finance, and Policy.
Health, Finance, and Policy.
Representative Cagle moves that House File 648 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. There is an author's amendment labeled DE5. Representative Cagle, would you move and describe that amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The DE5 is language that I worked on with DHS and the Minnesota Health Plans in order to get this to a place where everybody can support it. And so I just hope members can support the amendment and the bill. Thank you.
All right. And any discussion to the DE5? Representative Rasmussen, is this to the amendment or to the bill?
It's to the amendment, Mr. Chair. Quickly, for the bill author, Representative Cagle, I was wondering if you could explain, I'm looking at line 1.10 through 1.12 in the DE amendment, and it excludes managed care plans or county-based purchasing plans from the requirements that are laid out in Section 1A. I was wondering if you could explain why we're excluding individuals who are on public programs from this new requirement. Thank you.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. They are not excluded because of Section 2. So it just it makes it Section 2 is where that is addressed. And I know that somebody from DHS is also here if they want to explain that better.
Representative Rasmussen, are you satisfied with that answer? Did you?
I can follow up with Representative Cagle, but yeah, just concerned that about that language and just was wondering why it was in there given what we see in Section 2.
All right. Thank you. I had the same concern. So.
Okay. Any further discussion to the DE5? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We do have one testifier to the bill, Representative Dan Andreessen from the Council of Health Plans. He's in the committee enough that maybe that's why I thought he was a representative for a second there. Mr. Andreessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to mention, we appreciate working with Representative Kegel on the bill. We're now neutral on the bill, no longer have concerns. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. Any further discussion to the bill? Any brief closing comments, Representative Cagle? No brief closing comments, and I will take it that you will renew your motion that House File 648 be amended as amended as be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. Mr. Brown will take the roll, and the chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Katiza Watun.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Davney.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
No.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Representative Tice.
Tice, no.
There being 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 648, as amended, is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. As I mentioned a moment ago, House File 1292, while an excellent bill, we just don't have time for today. We will hear it on Tuesday or Wednesday of the upcoming week. Apologies to Representative Katiza Watun for that. Appreciate the committee's time and the animated discussion we had this morning. And with that, the committee is adjourned.